Upon arriving at Fort Dodge, the air was a frozen lace on their skins, sharp and cold, like winter ringlets on the pallid ground. The sky washed in the gray, damp light, shimmering delicate patches of flurried snow that footed about them. Upon Major Henry Douglas's arrival in early December 1866, no conditions were made for families to have a home, warmth, or comfort. His family was among the first to arrive at Fort Dodge, so the circumstances could have been more suited. Instead of moving into a warm wood or stone-constructed home fit for a commanding officer, the Douglas family occupied a sod dugout, which was the only available option. Wild West Podcast proudly presents In the Midst of Conflict, Part 3, Correspondence of Conflict. Before the new commander arrived, officers at Fort Dodge searched for suitable building materials to improve living conditions. Converting Fort Dodge from a dugout encampment to a permanent installation posed a strategic challenge for the U.S. Army due to the need for more timber, efficient transportation, and nearby quarries. The Army was willing to pay a premium for skilled carpenters. But when they found that local timber was not suitable for construction, they were made to depend on the principal native building material of the Southwest, adobe or sod. Major Henry Douglas bitterly complained, "The house I live in was no palace, but a hovel." Within a few days, Isidore, her husband, and three children, including a nursing baby, moved into a mud house with three rooms and a kitchen. Their sod structure faced the Arkansas River, and the builders covered the back and sides of the dirt structure with earth. Being close to the river, it was subject to high water, and raising three little boys in a dirt house would not have been easy. During this time, the dugout's roofs were elevated, and wooden bunks were constructed from the lumber provided by the first supply train. In addition, old tents were used to line the tops of the dwellings to ward off inclement weather. Isidore described her new home in a letter to her mother. "When we reached here, we had no house to go into. The men are building us three rooms and a kitchen. They are to be built of mud, like all the temporary houses here. They will be finished in a day or two. They are 3 feet below ground and four above. The floor is mud, or rather, we have no floors at all. We expect to put canvas on the floor. It is useless to put a carpet down. It is such a muddy place. Not a tree or a blade of grass at the post, there being no trees. We have to have mud houses. I will tell you all about our home when we get into it. Our boxes did not come with us, so that will be inconvenient. I fear our boxes are lost. Henry was sent here to take command of the post and build it. He will build the houses of a stone that is porous, harmless by explosives, and does not retain dampness." The heavy seasonal snow and sleet of winter quickly weakened all of the sod buildings, thereby appreciably dampening the enthusiasm of the garrison for continuing construction with that material. The sod found near the post was of poor quality, and continual soaking led to sagging walls and caved-in roofs. As the first civilian employees arrived to join the soldiers in erecting new structures, they were directed to construct badly needed storehouses and a corral for 50 horses. Most of the quartermaster's supplies were lost in the first year through exposure to the elements. Major Douglas, the new post commander, recognized the need to oversee the construction of a new fort. Still, he immediately recognized another more pressing problem: the many whiskey ranches surrounding the fort. Multiple whiskey granges, seated around the post during the formative years, proved to be recurring sources of problems for the soldiers. These enterprises were referred to as whiskey ranches by the military, echoing their proprietors' discretions. The Indian tribes along the Arkansas River tolerated these ranches because they were a primary source of liquor, guns, and ammunition. An astute owner of such an undertaking could anticipate as much as a 20-to-1 return on investments when trade goods were exchanged for horses, buffalo robes, or annuity currency given out to the Indians by government reservation agents. The public freighters often passing by the fort proved a severe problem for the garrison's officers. Enterprising wagon hands were well aware of the lucrative market for whiskey that could be found among the troops and civilians on the post, and gallons of the forbidden spirits were smuggled onto the post, despite the rigorous inspections that the post officers carried out. On December 21, 1866, Post Commander Douglas complained to the commander of the District of the Upper Arkansas. "I have the honor to report that several gallons of whiskey were smuggled into this camp last night and sold to the men and citizen employees of this command by the supply train under the charge of S.B. Hickok." The wagon master said Hickok is employed by Colonel Bradley, Chief QM of the district. The supply train left on its return before the facts were ascertained. "I therefore make this report so the commander of the district may investigate the matter as he deems proper." On January 13, 1867, Fort Dodge's commanding officer, Major Henry Douglas, wrote a crucial three-part correspondence to the department headquarters at Fort Leavenworth. The three-pronged letter provides a sense of unease over the sale of arms to the Indians and the discontentment with functions and oversight to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. In his correspondence, he accuses Charles Rath of selling arms and ammunition to the Kiowas and recommends suspending Rath from the Fort Zara Reservation. Investigations discovered that Rath was innocent of the charges. The true culprit was David Butterfield, who ran a trading post at Fort Larned. Butterfield was licensed to sell guns and ammunition to any tribe living at peace with the United States. According to Donald Berthong, his agents were selling arms by the case to Indians along the Arkansas River. "I consider it my duty to report what I have observed regarding Indian affairs in this country, so that the division's commanding general may make such representations to the Department of the Interior as he thinks proper. I will also include other helpful information. The issue and sale of arms and ammunition, such as breech-loading carbines and revolvers, powder and lead, loose and in cartridges, and percussion caps, continues without intermission. The issue of revolvers and ammunition is made by Indian agents, as authorized by the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, and traders make the sale of them in the most incredible abundance. Blitterfried, an Indian trader formerly of the Overland Express, has the most significant investment in Indian goods of all the traders. He has sold several cases of arms to the Cheyennes and Arapahoes. Charlie Rath, a trader at Zara, has armed several bands of Kiowas with revolvers and completely overstocked them with powder." Secondly, Major Douglas shares his discontent with the Bureau of Indian Affairs to be directly at fault for selling contraband whiskey and arms on the plains. Douglas complained bitterly to General Hancock, commander of the Department of Missouri, saying that Indians frequently arrived at the fort to collect their annuities armed with newly purchased revolvers. In addition, some of the more prosperous tribe members had acquired several handguns, which they treasured over rifles because of their ease in handling while on horseback. Between the authorized issue of agents and the sale of the traders, the Indians were never better armed than they were at present. Several hundred Indians had visited Fort Dodge, all of whom had revolvers in their possession. A large majority had two revolvers, and many of them had three. The Indians openly boast that they have plenty of arms and ammunition in case of trouble in the spring. To compound the problem with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Kicking Bird, a Kiowa subchief, had visited Fort Dodge. Kicking Bird, or Striking Eagle, was a Kiowa, though his grandfather had been a Crow captive whom the Kiowa adopted. Though he was a great warrior who participated in and led many battles and raids during the 1860s, he is mainly known as an advocate for peace. He fell into disfavor among his tribe when Indian-white friction resurfaced, following the Little Arkansas Treaty. This disfavor was because Kicking Bird was influential in maintaining peace, proving himself receptive to Indian and white demands. Because the treaty's terms were largely unfulfilled, it created hostilities throughout the tribes of the Plains Indians. After Dalhousie died in 1866, Satanta, White Bear, Quipago, Lone Wolf, and Kicking Bird became locked in an intense rivalry for leadership of the Kiowa. His calm and conciliatory demeanor facilitated an open relationship with whites, who admired him for his skills as an orator and diplomat. During Kicking Bird's visit with Major Douglas, he complained about Colonel Leavenworth, their agent stationed at Fort Zara. Kicking Bird states that only a few small band of Kiowas are receiving their annuities and would keep his share of the goods. When the Kiowas had moved onto the reservations, they had been promised annuity payments for buying food and supplies. However, the annuities were only sometimes paid, as promised, and handled by a corrupt agent who hampered the promised flow of goods. The Kiowa faced immense hardship as a result. Kicking Bird recognized that most of the bad feeling in his tribe stemmed from the annuity situation. Because of this, Kicking Bird was placed in a delicate position between warriors who wanted to go on the warpath and those who wanted peace with the whites. His close relationship with whites and peace talks belittled his leadership position in the eyes of many Kiowa. A great deal of dissatisfaction seems to have been created among the Indians by the unequal distribution of presents. Major Douglas writes, "The Kiowas complained bitterly about Colonel Leavenworth, their agent stationed at Fort Zara. Kicking Bird, chief of the Kiowa, states that only a few small bands of Kiowas got any presents. The balance last year got nothing. That it had been represented to Colonel Leavenworth that most of the bands were bad in their hearts and would not go to get their presents. That he, Kicking Bird, sent runners to tell Colonel Leavenworth that his stock was poor and he could not move in the goods. But Colonel Leavenworth would not listen and either gave all the goods to the bands then or sold them to other Indians and told them they would not get the goods that year. I don't know how much of this is true, but from all I can learn, there is at least some foundation for the story. Bad management, bad faith, and injustice will produce the worst results. Kicking Bird says that all bad feelings in his tribe are owing to the injustice of their agent, that it required all his influence to prevent an outbreak, and he is afraid that they will commence hostilities in the spring." Additionally, in the same January 13th letter, Major Henry Douglas reported that an all-out Indian war was looming. During his meetings, Kicking Bird warned that when spring came, there would be a council between the tribes of the northern and southern plains, with a war against the white intruders the likely result, as soon as the grass was 1 inch high. Kicking Bird says that the Sioux and Cheyenne asked his permission to cross the river and that he refused it for fear of trouble, but that his men wished them to cross. And he believes that they will all cross the river and that in the spring when the grass comes up, there will be war. He had been treated kindly at Fort Dodge or he would not tell us so, but we must look out for our lives and for our stock in the spring. As they talk now, he says all the tribes north and south of the Arkansas will be in the outbreak, his tribe among them. He also states that Satanta, or White Bear, a principal chief of the Kiowa, is always talking about war. They have already had a council at the Kiowa camp, which the Cheyenne, Sioux, Arapaho, Kiowa, and Apaches were represented, and it was agreed that as soon as the grass was old enough, they would commence war. He, Kicking Bird, had been treated kindly at Fort Dodge, and he wished to put us on our guard so that before spring the Indians might change their minds. But at present, their intention was war. He said he would frequently be backward and forward to give us the news. General Sherman knows the chief, Kicking Bird, who talked with him last fall. At this post, he is believed to be the most reliable of all the Indians. I would respectfully state that it is my purpose to keep the district and department informed of all the movements of Indians in large bodies as far as possible. It was not until early February that they found a nearby quarry of soft limestone and began using civilian labor. Construction commenced on two barracks designed to house 50 men, a formal headquarters, a commanding officer's quarters, a hospital, a quartermaster's depot, and supply buildings. Quarrying the stone miles from the fort exposed workers to Indian attack, and the experienced labor needed to construct permanent stone buildings was expensive. As much as $100 a month, or three times that of a moderate laborer. It is no accident that the first stone structures built in 1867 were the headquarters, commanding officers' quarters, hospital, and quartermaster storage building. Henry Douglas's wife, Isidore, wrote about her husband's plan to build splendid stone buildings within a year. But in 1867, many obstacles were standing in the way. Buildings will be very fine when finished. Henry thinks it will be done in a year. We are obliged to send 20 miles for the wood we burn. There are four companies here. Henry is going to have a nice post when built. There are three ladies with myself at the post, Lieutenant Wallace's wife, and Mr. Tapin's wife, the sutler. Write me very often, dear Ma, and cheer me. I am so lonely at this desolate place. Direct your letters to Mrs. Isidore Douglas, care Major Henry Douglas, commanding Fort Dodge, Kansas, via Fort Leavenworth. Still, in a series of letters to her mother, Mrs. Bowman, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Isidore painted an encouraging picture with minimal objections. After all, the dugout was comfortable except when the river flooded. And everyone at the fort knew that new living quarters were planned for officers and enlisted in the coming months. The following letter provides details of their journey and living conditions at the fort when they arrive. Your two very welcome letters reached us. I will answer them tonight, though I do not feel in the writing humor. I am quite blue today. You know how gloomy a rainy day is at post, and particularly this post, so far from civilization. It has rained today, and the wind is now howling so pitiful that I feel inclined to cry more than write. Then the baby is crying. I must wake him up. This is always the way the little rogue seems to know when I am busy. He insists upon my undivided attention. I have now got him in my arms. He nursing and just ready to snatch my pen. He is a bright little fellow who has lots of pretty ways, such as patacaking, putting his arms out to go to others, etc. I'm now keeping house. Our house consists of a dining room, a bedroom on either side of the dining room, a kitchen back of the dining room, and a lobby in front. We are 3 feet below ground, 4 feet above. They are very comfortable quarters, though the thermometer is below zero. We hardly know what is cold. We have 4 rooms, each room with a large stove. A river, the Arkansas, is about 10 yards back of the house. The houses here are more picturesque than elegant. I wish you could see our mud house. It looks gloomy now, but when our boxes come, I will fix it nicely. When our new quarters are done next year, we will live somewhat differently. Now we are living somewhat in the manner of prairie dogs. The men's quarters are holes, burrowed in the bank of the river. Ah, well, we are comfortable, although we are deprived of luxuries. I wish I had a rocking chair. I sometimes long to sit in one. The quartermaster had us a fine washboard made, a bookcase, a cupboard, washstand, bed, and Henry is sent east for a double iron bedstead. We are not half so badly off as you think we are. From various reports, Major Douglas believed an Indian war was looming and held a council with the Kiowa chiefs on February 9, 1867. He held conferences with Satanta, Stumbling Bear, and their followers. Satanta, the tribe's greatest orator and second most influential chief, was known for his bravery and recklessness in battle. Satanta was considered the worst Indian on the plains and the most dreaded for a long time. He was the war chief of the Kiowas. Many stories afloat about his doings at Fort Dodge, some of which are true, others not. Satanta warned that a council would occur between the tribes of the northern and southern plains in spring, with war against white intruders likely to occur. He demanded that Fort Dodge and Fort Larned be abandoned, and that soldiers and other whites cease using the resources of his people without compensation. He also wanted military units removed to a location no further west than Council Grove, the Santa Fe Trail, and other trails closed, and construction of railroad and telegraph lines across the southern plains halted. Satanta also requested better care for the livestock at Fort Dodge. He wanted the horses and mules fattened so that he would have prized animals when he took Fort Dodge. He gave Major Douglas 10 days to move. When Satanta had remained at the fort for a long time and had worn out his welcome so that no one would give him anything to drink, he went up to the quarters of his friend Bill Bennett, the stage agent, and begged him for liquor. Bill was mixing a bottle of medicine to drench a sick mule, and the moment he set the bottle down to do something else, Satanta picked it up and drank most of its contents before stopping. Of course, it made the savage dreadfully sick, as well as angry. He then went up to a particular officer's quarters and again begged there for liquor to cure him of the effects of the previous dose, but the officer refused. Still, Satanta persisted. He would not leave, and after a while, the officer went to his closet and took a swallow of balsam copaiba, placing the bottle back. Satanta watched his opportunity, seized the bottle, and drank its contents as soon as the officer left the room. That, of course, was a worse dose than the horse medicine, and the next day, the wily Satanta called his people together, crossed the Arkansas, and went south. Before leaving, however, he burnt Mr. Coriel's hay, which was stacked opposite the fort. He then continued to Crooked Creek, where he killed 3 woodchoppers, all of which he said he did in revenge for trying to poison him twice at Fort Dodge. Just after Satanta departed from Fort Dodge, Isidor wrote her 4th letter to her mother in February 1867. In the letter, she describes the weather in Kansas, how the baby keeps her busy, what their house is like for housekeeping requirements, some leisure activities, and some excitement at the fort when they believe they are under attack. We had quite a little excitement the other night. Henry had gone out. The man, soldier cook, was sleeping in the kitchen, and I had gone to bed. I first heard the sentinel calling for the corporal of the guard 3 or 4 times. Then he fired his musket. Then the other sentinels fired their muskets. They kept loading and firing for about 15 minutes. I could see the flash from the window. I called the man. He put on his equipment for a fight. The long roll, drum, continued to beat for everybody to come out. I would not let the man go, but got Henry's pistol. I stood in front of the man while he was fixing the pistol. Then I said I will lay the baby was in my arms, with the boys, and I will sit on the bed with them and defend them with my pistol, while you run out and see which way the Indians are coming. I had not gone from him 2 seconds when I heard the report of the pistol, and the man said, "Oh!" I thought they had commenced firing our house, when the man said, "My pistol went off by accident. I stood in front of him 2 seconds before, he might have killed me and my baby." The ball passed through the door of the room where I stood and hit the stove. The alarm proved to be the corral on fire. The soldiers were sleeping, and the officers were all at the sutler's store outside the garrison. The sentinels could not make anyone hear by calling, and so they fired. The officers were without arms, so they picked up stones and ran to the garrison. We have no blockhouses here, but good breastworks. There is not much danger now, but in the springtime will be more. Henry is preparing for it. He's building redoubts, etc. They can never take this fort. We have only 3 companies now. I am getting so well and strong. I ride horseback, shoot at a mark. I beat Henry the other day shooting a target. I made the most beautiful line shot you ever saw. Most houses are not damp. The little boys will be so glad for the Valentines. Poor little fellows have no amusements here. I must say good night. Write often, for I have so little here to interest me. Affectionately, your daughter, Isidore Douglas. P.S. Your property must be worth a great deal. Baby's name is Charles Edward, after Henry's eldest brother. He was baptized the day before we left Columbus, Ohio. We have canned jellies also in the commissary. My washing is $20 a month. We have 100 employees building this post. In the same February letter, Isidore mentions the high cost of $20 a month for getting her laundry done. At that time, each company had permission to appoint up to 4 women as post laundresses. It was a common practice to employ women solely to serve officers. However, problems would sometimes arise when some men during their free time competed for the attention of post laundresses. Our surroundings are poor. We live in a miserable house in a wild desert, but we have plenty to eat. We get canned tomatoes, canned peas, and corn from the commissary. They are perfectly splendid, as well as milk, butter, eggs for $1 a pound, and $1 a dozen. We live as well as you do in the East, but must pay a hefty price for everything. The sutler brought up some oysters at $10 a can. We got one, but we do not know the price. I have a soldier cook and a little girl to care for baby. I pay the little girl $10 a month. Tell Mary, if she has come here with me, she could have $35 a month. That's what girls get out here. It's such a hard old place that girls won't come here unless they get big wages. It was discovered that the women hired for laundry work were also responsible for other duties. Any enlisted men who did not wash their own clothes or pay for the service on a per-piece basis were charged $6 each month for a laundress. This cost could be significant, especially if only a few men were using the service. In fact, the $6 fee represented nearly half of an enlisted private's salary. When the men were relocated, the laundresses would typically move with them from post to post. At first, the laundresses lived in dugouts at Fort Dodge, but they were later given better housing once the enlisted men moved into permanent barracks. On one occasion, a colonel who was ordered to report to Camp Supply from Fort Hays asked the commander at Fort Dodge to provide transportation for his 2 personal laundresses to his new station. This request annoyed the commander, who reported it to his superiors. As a consequence, the colonel was severely reprimanded. After that, he informed a Fort Dodge officer that he would never trust his judgment again. From time to time, the laundresses were too arrogant and had their duties limited by the post commander. The commander would issue orders reminding all military personnel to sleep in their quarters and prohibiting the laundresses from staying in the officers' quarters, where they were making the officers' stay more comfortable. On March 14, 1867, Major Douglas sent a report to Brevet Major H.E. Noves, acting Assistant Adjutant General at the Headquarters District, Upper Arkansas. The following report from Major Douglas at Fort Dodge describes a communication received about the Kiowa Indians, who have been making threatening demonstrations and sending insulting messages. Major, in answer to your communication, February 21st, just received relating to the names of the chiefs or bands of Kiowa Indians who are or have been making threatening demonstrations or sending insulting messages, I have the honor to state that I received from Little Raven, head chief of the Arapahoes, a message to the effect that this command must cut no more wood on the Pawnee Forks, and that the troops must move out of the country by the time the grass grows. Mr. Jones, the interpreter at this post, brought me a message from Satanta, the principal chief of the Kiowas, to the effect that all white men must move east of Council Grove by the spring, that he gave me 10 days to move from this post, that he wanted the mules and cavalry horses fattened, as he would have use for them, for he intended to appropriate them, that all the Indians had agreed to stop the railroads and roads at Council Grove, that no roads or railroads would be allowed west of that point. Major J.H. Page, 3rd Infantry, brought me a message from the same chief. Tell the chiefs on the road that they must gather together their soldiers and leave. If they don't, I will help them to leave. No wagons will be allowed on the road except those that bring presents. If any are found, they will be taken to headquarters. It has been reported to me that 8 Arapahoes, apparently friendly, stopped on the 10th instant at the camp of Mr. Gilchrist, a wagon master for a Mr. Weddells of Mora, New Mexico, on the other side of Fort Aubrey, 120 miles from here, shot at the herder, and run off 40 head of mules and one mare. The extreme severity of the weather and the man who reported the facts' refusal to act as a guide and put a party on their trail prevented me from attempting their recovery. To resolve the problem of whiskey ranches and arms sales, Major Douglas devised a new plan by forming a reservation around Fort Dodge. When orders were received in the early spring of 1866 to establish a military reservation around the fort, survey parties were sent out to ascertain the location of the most advantageous terrain that might be included. It was decided that it would be necessary to establish the northern boundary of the reservation approximately 14 miles above the post, so that adequate reserves of stone, timber, and grass could be held for the future use of the garrison. The western boundary commenced at the 100th meridian and extended more than 5 miles eastward at the widest point. Slightly more than 43,000 acres were included in the reservation. Also, in the early spring of 1867, the personnel working on the buildings faced significant challenges to complete their work due to the sporadic attacks by surrounding Indians, who targeted both the personnel and the supplies of the post. The supply wagons that were headed for Fort Dodge were regularly attacked, and during one such raid, the attackers managed to steal a shipment of firearms and ammunition that was badly needed at the post. They also took 5 wagons loaded with subsistence supplies. Multiple Indian raids were conducted on work details sent out under military guard to quarry stone, cut firewood, procure lime for the post masons, or stack hay for the fort's livestock during winter. The raiding parties varied in size from a few to several hundred participants. These attacks had a significant impact on the post morale. Few laborers wanted to work on the plains of Kansas for only $35 a month if there was a possibility of being murdered and scalped. Lieutenant George A. Hesselberger was responsible for overseeing the construction of the barracks, and he demonstrated a keen eye for durability and subtle beauty. The stones used in the building were of varying lengths, but they were cut to a uniform height of 18 inches and a thickness of 2 feet. Skilled civilian masons then dressed the heavy rocks before they were put into place. Each barracks building was designed to accommodate approximately 50 men and featured a kitchen, mess room, and dormitory for the soldiers. The latrines were located just behind the barracks. The hospital plans included a ward room that could house up to 4 companies worth of 6 soldiers, along with an attached administration section for hospital personnel and a separate kitchen. In the spring of 1867, Lieutenant Hesselberger expressed his concern for the Department of Missouri regarding the slow construction process due to a shortage of men and materials. Skilled craftsmen, including carpenters, masons, and blacksmiths willing to work under challenging conditions, were paid between $85 and $100 monthly. On the other hand, Common laborers were offered $35 per month. Wagons were used to transport lumber and hardware for construction over the Santa Fe Trail from eastern Kansas or Santa Fe, New Mexico. Although the latter was the preferred source of supplies, the materials had to be transported further due to the lower price offered. In 1867, 1,000 board feet of lumber could be delivered to Fort Dodge from Santa Fe for only $30. In March of 1867, construction projects at the fort ceased after Major Douglas submitted a report mentioning an Indian council he had with Satanta, where he was threatened with an attack in the spring. Upon receiving this report, Hancock sent orders to gather intelligence on the intentions of southern tribes, provide more guides and interpreters, and monitor movements in Indian camps. Scouts were instructed to watch for signs of attacks or a supply of guns to the Indians, and to check for Sioux Indians among the southern tribes. War was imminent, and all attention had to be given to the possibilities of defending against conflict. As we close, we would like to express our gratitude to Joan Van Covern for publishing the story of the Letters of Isidor and Henry Douglas, 1866-1867, in the August 2016 edition of the Santa Fe Trail Wagon Tracks newsletter. That's it for now. Remember to check out our Wild West Podcast shows on iTunes or wildwestpodcast.buzzsprout.com. You can also catch us on Facebook at facebook.com/wildwestpodcast or on our YouTube channel at Wild West Podcast, Mike King, YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to our shows listed at the end of the description text of this podcast to receive notifications on all new episodes. Thanks for listening to our podcast. Make sure you check out the Western Cattle Trail Association website at westerncattletrailassociation.com. If you have any comments or want to add to our series, please write us at wildwestpodcast@gmail.com. We will share your thoughts as they apply to future episodes. Join us next time as we travel back to 1866 and tell the story of the first cattle town of Abilene, Kansas, as we revisit the stories of a disorderly town brought to declaration by two very famous law officers, Thomas James Smith and Wild Bill Hickok.